Welcome to Oncology Today, the role of oral selective estrogen receptor degraders in the management of ER-positive metastatic breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Professor Patrick Nevin from the University Hospitals Leuven in Leuven, Belgium. To begin, I asked him to reflect back on the therapeutic advances made in ER-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer over recent years.
I have never seen this real revolution in the treatment of endocrine-sensitive, endocrine-resistant patients. We have never had so many drugs to treat this disease, and we see improved survival. So this really has been, especially the last 10 years, a revolution.
Yeah, I was going to say that before 10 years ago, most of the exciting stuff was like triple negative and HER2 positive particularly. And we didn't really say too much about endocrine therapy. Now we do entire programs just on metastatic therapy in ER positive disease. But I wanted to also, again, get into a few specific things you brought up. And one was one of the first cases you presented was an incredible case. It looks like a woman who's been on treatment for metastatic disease, I think, for 9 years. If I add this up, this is the woman who got letrozole, now is on imlunestrant from being on a trial. And I guess she never got a CDK inhibitor. So I don't know if you said this, but was she ESR1 positive?
We still don't know because she was part of the AMBER-3 trial. You understand? So we don't know, and we should not know, but we will test her if she is becoming progressive again. But she did respond already now 2 years on imlunestrant. So this is really a success. And she, you know, can still have endocrine treatment for the next line with the CDK4/6 inhibitor, of course. My guess is that she has the mutation, yes.
But, you know, it also brings up the question if she does have the mutation, because, you know, we hear that you see ESR1 mutations in people who are endocrine resistant. From what I know, you don't see this after even 5 years of an adjuvant AI, or am I wrong? You don't usually see this in the first line setting. Why don't you see it? And this lady only had letrozole, so if you think she has an ESR1 mutation, like, you know, do you see this with just AIs, or you need a CDK inhibitor, and how come?
Well, that's a very good question. We know that in first line, at the basis, when we start after only adjuvant AI, we don't see them, you are correctly. We only see them in 2 or 3%, and then they start to appear. And because we know at the CDK4/6 inhibitor, as you mentioned, patients are much longer exposed to AI, and we see them when they relapse after a couple of years. And especially if these patients had luminal A disease, especially if the progesterone receptor is positive. And also, it has been seen that when PIK3CA is active, we are more likely to see these estrogen receptor mutated. So this is really still an endocrine-sensitive disease. So the ER needs to be targeted by these oral SERDs because fulvestrant's bioavailability is too low. The intramuscular is not really good for the patients. So we really have now a good alternative, which is much more potent in the ESR1 mutated patients with the oral SERDs.
Could you talk a little bit about what you've observed in terms of GI tolerability with the various SERDs? Do you think there's a difference? Do you think the new PROTAC vepdegestrin has less GI toxicity, or is they all kind of the same?
Well, it's still early days, but my personal experience, because we now have given camizestrant and imlunestrant in the early setting in these adjuvant trials, and they are quite okay. So what the patients did get prior to having these oral SERDs in the metastatic setting might also affect the side effect profile. But indeed, patients do complain of a heavy stomach, dyspepsia, and it's low grade, but I have seen some patients who really, it was, you know, too difficult and they had to either lower the dose or to discontinue the treatment. But it's unlikely, and it's for the, let me say, median patients, there is no issue.
How about the PROTAC?
Personally, we did include patients in the VERITAC trial, and it was my experience that it was very easy to manage these patients, and patients, they felt quite okay with it. But again, if you look to the New England Journal of Medicine paper that was recently published on VERITAC 2, GI was also reported as one of the potential side effects. Low grade, yes.
Just out of curiosity, not to get too far out on a tangent, if vepdegestrant were available, would it be sort of a coin flip between that and a SERD, or would you prefer the PROTAC?
I have no preferences. I can understand your question very well, and I don't believe there is enough data now to go for one or the other. So I think I would take the one I have. But unfortunately, in Belgium, even elacestrant is not reimbursed. It's FDA and EMA approved, but it's not yet reimbursed. We still have to do with fulvestrant and the CDK4/6 inhibitor. We still have to do with exemestane and everolimus. So you see, it's not yet available for all the patients. We had an early access program that now has stopped because our authorities decided not to reimburse elacestrant.
So another sort of preliminary question before we get more into clinical management relates to this press release you just mentioned that just came out a couple of days ago, looking at giredestrant, unapproved at this point, combined with everolimus. And I know we haven't seen the data. As you said, I'm sure we'll see it very soon. But can you just talk about this? I had a hard time sort of processing even what they were looking at there. And you know, particularly the preliminary report there that it's positive and intent to treat as well as ESR1 mutant. And, you know, another thing made me think a little bit is, you know, I don't know if everybody kind of thinks about everolimus as an AKT inhibitor, but I guess it is within that class. And yet we don't look for a biomarker with it. But conceptually, do you see it similar to, you know, the other AKT inhibitors, CAPI and Vasertib? And what do you think this trial is going to mean? Can you explain, like, who's in it?
So they included all patients, but I did read the press release, and it was really, I think, it were really patients with the ESR1 mutation. And if you, I think, have more than 50% of patients with an ESR1 mutation in the clinical trial, your median PFS will be driven by this group of ESR1 mutated. So I'm not sure that the ITT population does have a benefit if you look to the wild-type ESR1 patients. Indeed, there is no biomarker, so this is a problem. Indeed, combining a drug with everolimus, as you know, is toxic. Was this working as a single agent treatment? Because many of these patients had to reduce the everolimus or even had to stop early the everolimus. So this is a big question. And also, I'm looking forward to see more details of that Evera trial. Yes.
So, yeah, that should be very interesting. All right, well, let's get into the main thing I wanted to discuss with you. So one survey we did was of 20 clinical investigators in breast cancer. So very prominent people that we work with. A lot of them were on the NCCN committee. But the other was of 50 community-based general medical oncologists. So these are the same docs who are taking care of myeloma and CLL, bladder cancer, et cetera. So we also asked them, and, you know, every program we do nowadays, there's like a ton of new things for them to digest, and it's a real challenge. And so one of the things we assessed was, how familiar were they with the key phase 3 trials that, you know, are considered? And you discussed a lot of them in your talk. And what was interesting is that we identified 12 phase 3 trials that we felt like they for sure needed to know about. A lot of them, you know, you mentioned the Emerald trial, Ember 3, Serena 6. Also some of the ADC trials that I think are relevant, HER2-low, TROP2. So I guess the first thing I was realizing is that it's a real, you know, kind of a good indicator of how complicated it is to be a general medical oncologist, that they, just for this one subset of patients, ER positive, mainly second line therapy, they need to know about 12 different trials in order to make a decision. I'm sure you deal with general medical oncologists a lot. I'm sure you get a lot of referrals to them. Any thoughts about the challenge? You know, we, of course, they do see a lot of breast cancer, but they see a lot of other things too. Any comments on your perception about how they deal with that? We actually found they feel they're pretty well informed about these trials when we ask them. Any thoughts, any myths or misperceptions you see in general medical oncologists about endocrine therapy?
Yes, I think we are very well informed, and working in a university hospital and only being focused on the management of breast cancer, I do early and late stage breast cancer. I'm also operating on these patients. I'm responsible for the systemic endocrine treatment with combinations, not chemotherapy. So my field of interest, of course, I'm very focused. But if I see referrals from patients, well, you know, we still can add on to the current management of these patients. We can still extend the treatment, delaying the start of chemotherapy ADCs. And I think there is an important place for people like you and your team bringing out the latest, what is clinically important, what is new, and these biomarkers. It's well known by the ESMO guidelines, the ASCO guidelines, that we should look for biomarkers, doing new biopsies, because these can change at progression. So the question was on how we can teach the medical oncologist who's not really focused, like myself, on adding new treatment options, new information on recent trials. It's going so quick. We have so many trials. We have so many different compounds. You know, we have five different certs, how to choose one from the other. It's difficult, but that's why we need some consensus meetings. That's like we need teaching. I think your faculty is doing a great job by bringing these messages. Doing surveys will help physicians to think about it. It's important, yes.
Yeah, you know, what we do is kind of what we call going beyond the guidelines, because, you know, guidelines tend to focus on evidence levels, et cetera, et cetera. But what we do in our surveys is we just ask people what they usually do in their practices, the same thing that everybody asks experts, like, you're in this situation, what do you do? And I wanted to kind of get into some of the major things we saw, and particularly in terms of the big phase three trials that you talked about. First of all, Emerald. And one thing I thought was interesting, when we looked at the amount of times that they've used various agents, I thought it was interesting that median of five times that they'd used elacestrant, so, you know, fair number, you know, was, I guess, presented several years ago and then approved. Capivasertib only twice, average of two times, and actually more than half of them had not used inavolisib as part of a triplet, so they clearly have more experience with SERDs. You know, in terms of, you know, typical situations that they face all the time, and, you know, one thing in general is we saw very similar answers in the general oncologists and in the investigators, with a couple of exceptions that I'm going to bring up to you, but a lot of similarities in how they respond in the typical situation of a patient progressing on a CDK. So I guess one issue was the patient who progresses on a CDK inhibitor and endocrine therapy who has an ESR1 mutation as PIK3 wild type, the classic kind of Emerald situation. We see an overwhelming number of people using elacestrant in that situation. But one of the things that's interesting is how that changes when you decrease the amount of time on CDK. So if we say the patient was on a CDK inhibitor for 2-3 years, everybody in the ESR1 mutant, everybody says elacestrant, but now we ask for 10 months and you get a lot different answers. It depends a little bit on, you know, how much tumor the patient has. If we say there's symptomatic visceral mets, it's one thing, versus minimally symptomatic bone mets. So I'm just curious in general, again, putting aside reimbursement, you mentioned the difficulty you have there in Belgium accessing it. But just sort of theoretically, assuming you have the kinds of options available that you'd like to, how do you see making the decision when you have ESR1 mutant, PIK3 wild type, and what do you start thinking about as in time when CDK decreases? Do you use the 1-year point in general? How do you think through that decision?
Yes, of course, like in all centers, we have a MDT, multidisciplinary team decision, discussing weekly what is the best treatment option, and time on prior treatment seems to be a very important prognostic and predictive factor for oral SIRT elacestrant. If it's less than 6 months, we all agree we shouldn't re-challenge the patients with a single agent, because then we might need combination treatments. And you have, as you mentioned already, look for other potential resistant mechanisms that you might be able to target. If it's more than 12 months, it's quite fine. But indeed, between 6 and 12 months, we look to the performance state of the patients. Is there visceral disease or not? What sort of side effects did the patient experience? Maybe she stopped with the CDK4/6 because of side effects. So a lot of things need to be put into the balance to make a decision. Yes.
So the other relevant situation that, of course, we've been hearing about so much, we keep bringing this up in surveys, is the doubly mutated patient, the patient with both ESR1 mutation as well as PIK3. We've always seen heterogeneity and how people respond there. But I guess one thing that came out as we were doing these things is when you consider the side effect profile of the two options, which would be obviously ASERD versus HAT PIK3, generally capivasertib versus with fulvestrant, with the perception that SIRDs are much easier on the patient. So generally, even if double mutated patients, they don't have visceral disease, they have long time with CDK. If they're doubly mutant, we saw most people going with elacestrant. But again, as we decreased the amount of time, we saw more capi, we saw more, you know, chemotherapy, capecitabine, et cetera. Again, is it your general approach, theoretically, if you're doubly mutated, if possible, go with the SERD first? And in what situations would you use something else?
We have, and I was co-author on the paper with Sarah Tolaney, published in Clinical Cancer Research, subgroup analysis from Monarch 2. If you have double mutated ESR1 and PI3K activated pathway, that's still fulvestrant plus abemaciclib is active in these endocrine resistant patients. But that was before they were pretreated with CDK4/6 inhibition. Today we have data from Emerald that even if you have a double mutation, ESR1 mutated, that instead of going to the 9 months, you reach the 6 months. So it's still clinically meaningful to give this single agent elacestrant. So that means that if PIK3CA is activated, you can still block your target, the estrogen receptor. So you're quite right. If you go to specific PIK3CA inhibitors, capivasertib, alpelisib, it's very toxic. And, you know, we see these patients stopping because of side effects more than stopping because of progression.
And I guess the other thing that's been pointed out to me that I didn't realize initially, which is I think there is not data for capivasertib with ESR1 mutant, the doubly mutated. So we have it with elacestrant, but we don't really have it for capi. So, okay, yes, so far so good in terms of these surveys. So, of course, we wanted to see what people thought about the two big phase 3 trials of SERDs that have been presented in the last 6 months, the EMBER-3 study and the SERENA-6 study. So EMBER-3, I thought was very interesting because I remember when it was presented, I wasn't really sure how to process it. And we were doing all these CME programs and I was asking the faculty, what do you think? And they're all like very pro-positive. But I was still having a tough time trying to process how they did the trial. Now, this summer, essentially all the investigators are interested in using this type of strategy, imlunestrant, abema, you know, whether or not it could be a different SERD or different CDK. Even in the first line, they bring it up as something they would consider, but definitely in the second line. And you also see that in the general oncologists, not quite as many, but very similar acceptance of the EMBER-3 strategy. So I'm curious, again, of course, I'm talking about the combination arm, too, and I guess the other issue would be about the monotherapy arm. So I guess the two questions I remember asking people at San Antonio were, could you see if imlunestrant were available? Do you think there'd be any situation where you'd prefer it over elacestrant? Would you like to have it available as a, you know, possible utilization? And then, of course, In what situations, if any, would you like to use the combination strategy like imlunestrant and CDK or abemaciclib?
All right. So I think the AMBER-3 is actually two clinical trials that were targeting a different population and clearly seen that you need to target ESR1 mutated if you go for single agent treatment. And if you don't look to the target and if you compare the imlunestrant with the combination, that you see really a meaningful difference of 4 to 5 months more median PFS. But if you have a patient who is wild type and she progressed and she has a low disease burden, ESR1 is wild type, and she has no other resistant mechanisms, I think still there's a place for fulvestrant or the combination fulvestrant with abemaciclib. This is really the arm that we needed. Okay, we don't have the arm. We can only imagine that imlunestrant plus abemaciclib is at least as good, probably better, than fulvestrant with abemaciclib. So if you request this to your medical oncologist that you do surveys, I do understand that if they don't have the possibility to look for the biomarker, that they go for the combination. So you don't need a biomarker. But I think you should do this biomarker, as all guidelines do say, because as long as you can go for single agent, you have a improved quality of life. I'm 100% positive that you can still use the combination if that patient is progressed on that single agent oral SERD. So for me also, it was an ambiguous trial, not easy to understand. And the patients that we did include were maybe not the patients that we see today, but which clinician is going to randomize today a patient in the study prior CDK4/6 inhibition plus endocrine treatment? You should realize that a lot of these patients didn't have prior CDK4/6 inhibition. So the trial, I can understand you that it's very difficult to explain, but the two groups do remain. Single agent is better than standard of care if you have an ESR1 mutation. And we now know that we even have a better combining it. It's more toxic, it's more expensive. We don't have an OS benefit yet, but it might come.
Another thing we saw was in both the investigators and general oncologists was a significant use of the post-monarch strategy using CDK after CDK. And in a way, when I think about EMBER-3, maybe it's too simplified, but it's kind of like you're adding a SERD and post-monarch together. I guess the problem is it's hard to see how much benefit from each. But in any event, that seemed like it's something that there's a lot of interest in. And then the last thing that I think was really the most interesting thing, and of course I really wanted to find out about, was how people responded to SERENA-6. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I read your take on this as kind of similar to the discussant for SERENA-6, Dr. DeMichel, who said, it's a little bit early now, we need to wait before we do that. Is that, am I reading you correctly, that that's what you're thinking, that even if you had it available, you really wouldn't want to do it right now, or would you want to?
No, it's too early. There are a lot of issues. As I mentioned, I think there is the monitoring of these patients every 3 months. It's very expensive. You need a good assay. There is the inconsistency in number of lines that these patients had. We have immature OS data. You know, these patients were treated with different lines of treatment. I don't think you can compare it. If you have an OS benefit, it might be explained by earlier introducing new treatments that the patients in the control arm were not able to get. So I think the proof of principle is there. It's super interesting, molecular progression as compared to anatomic progression. But my take was, if you have the emergence of an estrogen receptor mutation, the AI combination with CDK4/6 inhibition was still efficient for 9.1 months. And then you gain 7 extra months if you change early.
So that's kind of the way I was thinking about it all summer until I saw these data. So let me share what these docs said. And remember, this is, you know, people interpret clinical trials in different ways. And I think the sentiment that you expressed, like I said, that's sort of the message I was getting in general. But then I started looking at these data, and it was quite interesting. So we surveyed 20 investigators about this question, and 13 said what you did, but 7 said they would like to use it now. And there were some pretty prominent people in there as well. I'm going to have to identify them, but these are very elite people we work with all the time. And interestingly, in the general medical oncology group, 2/3 of the oncologists said they wanted to use this arena strategy now. And I was like, well, that's interesting, a different point of view. And I've been thinking about it a lot because, you know, this is a common issue in oncology, I think, where you have data where you see PFS advantage. Happens all the time. You don't have survival benefit. There's so many things to think about. Also, the issue of quality of life. I think the SERENA-6 study, there was some, at least they presented some initial quality of life data. I think there's hopefully going to present some more. And it looked like it was improved with the intervention, although it started early. And somebody brought up to me, maybe some of the quality of life was just coming off an aromatase inhibitor that the SERD is better tolerated. So maybe some of that. And of course, if you're diagnosed with metastatic progression, more likely you're going to have symptoms, emotional issues, and you know, you certainly could understand if the quality of life was better. It often comes out. And it really made me rethink this question of consensus and, you know, what comes out of guidelines, because usually they express the majority point of view, but a lot of times you don't hear the minority point of view. And I see that there's a significant minority point of view. It's interesting that it's more in the general oncologists, and I think it, to some extent it might be because they have been exposed over and over to situations like this where maybe the data is not 100% supportive, but I think one of the things that they've seen over the years, that we've seen over the years, is the idea of suppose you were to present it to a patient. Suppose you had a patient who was on first-line therapy for a metastatic disease with a CDK inhibitor and an AI or fulvestrant, and the patient was a medical oncologist. So they were fully able to understand, the data, and they said to you, look, I understand maybe there's not going to be a survival benefit, but looking at all this, I would rather be treated. And I wonder what you'd see if you asked people and tried to explain to them what it meant. We've done surveys like that of patients. And, you know, the classic study of adjuvant chemotherapy and breast cancer that from, I think Australia in the 1980s, where women were willing to go through chemotherapy for very minimal benefit. And every time we've done this, we find a subset of patients who, particularly if the treatment is not very toxic, really would value something like a PFS advantage. So I guess my question is, if you feel that really it's not ready for prime time, so to speak, would you like to be able to present it to a patient and give it to the patient if they wanted it?
My take from SERENA-6 is that particular patient being a medical oncologist and being well aware of what we have seen, PFS1, PFS2, I would say to the patient, we have data. If you have anatomical progression with an ESR1 mutation, we still have a very good drug available. That in SERENA-6 was not given in second line. I have many of these patients, not medical oncologists, of course, where we see an increase in CA15.3 before we see anatomical changes on CT scans or PET CT. And then also, we are able to see the patient and say, we never treat patients based on CA15.3. So I think there is a bit of similarity, but I can understand that some clinicians, physicians want to change early to prolong this median PFS because it's still endocrine treatment and some of these patients might have to go in second line to chemotherapy. And indeed, that's the patient that you want not to see and to treat early. But we still don't know. I think we need more data from SERENA-6. What was the dynamics of the circulating tumor DNA in these patients? Is there a group of patients who do benefit more than another group? So I think it's too early, and we may have to wait a little bit more longer to get this into the clinic. But I agree that some of these physicians and clinicians might believe there is a place already today.
So also you mentioned the term molecular progression. The first time I heard that was in the discussion at ASCO. I never heard that before. And I kind of really wonder, is it really molecular progression? I mean, it's kind of like not that you turn from MRD positive to negative. It's a resistance mutation. Do you believe it's kind of molecular progression?
Well, we know that it's subclonal. So you have a group of patients who have E or a wild type. Mutated receptor seems to be always present, and you can only find them at one particular moment. But clearly, the moment that we see it at the appearance in the plasma is not the moment that these patients do relapse. Because remember, a couple of patients couldn't be randomized because they had anatomic progression at the time that the mutation did appear. So if there is no molecular progression at that time, it still takes 9 months to see it. So this is a very selected group of patients. And if you don't watch these patients so closely, it might still take longer to find progression in these patients. But I think molecular progression is a good word. Maybe we should use ctDNA progression, and maybe it has nothing to see with ESR1, but now we have the target with oral SERDs. It might be more broadly ctDNA. What the ARTC study do in early breast cancer is looking to ctDNA from the tumor. So this is very specific and maybe another way to treat these patients. But I think molecular progression is the future, and I hope we will see that this is also going to be introduced in the clinic when it's more feasible to monitor these patients.
Yeah, the ctDNA MRD type assay that you see in colon cancer and now you see in breast cancer, I mean, all the adjuvant trials are incorporating that. And that, to me, that is progression, at least in terms of ctDNA. Another thing I was going to ask you is, you use the term subclonal a number of times. Like, how would you define subclonal?
So you have a clone. One cell becomes two. That's a clone. That cell is identical to the first cell. But then you have subclonal mutation that some of these cells, they become mutated, while the majority of these cells still have the wild type. So subclonality is polyclonal. There are more codons programming for different mutations. So it's polyclonal because we have at least five different mutations that we can look for. And subclonal, that the majority of these cells might remain wild type and not being resistant to endocrine treatment. And the small group will become more apparent with endocrine treatment pressure. That's how I see it.
So another thing I wanted to ask you about is one of the investigators who did not want to use the SERENA-6 strategy said, quote, that they didn't like the design of SERENA-6, and they didn't explain why. But I see also there's a trial, TREAT-DNA. It sounds a lot like SERENA-6, but it's with elacestrant. How is the design of that compared to SERENA-6, and are there any things about SERENA-6 design or the way it was conducted that people have questioned?
It's the one I just mentioned. It's the ERTC. It's called Search for Circulating Tumor DNA. So it's early breast cancer. It's high-risk breast cancer. So these patients are already in the trajectory of adjuvant endocrine treatment with no progression at a certain point. So at least 2 years on treatment, but high risk of relapse. Patients get the tumor sent to a lab. There, the DNA of the primary tumor is being assessed. The patient, 5 years later sometimes, with a high risk of relapse, sent a plasma specimen to the lab, and they match the DNA from the primary tumor with the circulating tumor DNA years after treatment. And that's the appearance, the emergence of circulating tumor DNA, not particularly for the estrogen receptor, but just tumor DNA in general. These patients are then randomized to elacestrant or to continuing the endocrine treatment when they take it. So that's the TREAT circulating tumor DNA trial from the ERTC.
Right. Oh, I see. It's an early stage. That's interesting.
It's early stage,
what
yes.
What about... Okay, so it is very different than SERENA-6. And then in terms of other trials in the localized setting, I guess mainly adjuvant trials, I know there's some where they start out with a SERD from the beginning. There's others. You mentioned this one here with looking at ctDNA. I think there's others where they just switch after 2 to 5 years. I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of where you think this is going to land in terms of SERDs and localized disease. Do you feel comfortable putting a patient on an adjuvant SERD and not on an AI, for example, in a trial?
Yes, that's why we are participating in these trials, and I named 5 adjuvant oral SERD trials. I feel quite comfortable. And if patients are a while on endocrine treatment and they can, between 2 and 5 years, be randomized to the continuation of the treatment and the oral SERD, my impression is that it's immediately seen that these patients have less arthralgia, less hot flushes. They also experience a vagina that is less atrophic. So there are advantages by side effects being avoided, not taking the aromatase inhibitor. According to what is going to be efficient, we have to wait years and years. Giving the oral SERD at the start is a challenge, because if you now realize that they might be better only if the mutation of the estrogen receptor has appeared, is a challenge. But there we include very high-risk patients. Again, one of the strategies to motivate these patients is that we have a compound that seems to be more efficient in resistant patients, that it has been seen with other compounds also be more efficient in the adjuvant setting. I refer to AI versus tamoxifen 30 years ago, that we have to give it a chance, and we have to await to answer your very important question for several more years. But I still hope we can see it.
Well, the other thing is kind of, I think, related is you always hear people talking about SERDs as, well, you see benefit with the ESR1 mutant, but you don't with the wild type. But yet, it looks like it's equivalent to the control arm. I mean, I know it's not an equivalency study, but do you think in general I know it's not better, but do you think it's equivalent?
Yes, that's my thought. That's why I have put in one of my slides data from MAINTAIN and data from AMBER-3, where patients were wild-type and where the oral SERD is not better in single agent than the standard of care. So I think that should be included in the guidelines, and that is not. So I think even in Belgium, where we don't have elacestrant, we should continue looking for the mutation, because if it's wild-type, I give fulvestrant with or without the CDK4/6 inhibition, another chance. I have shown this three-circle slide with different mechanisms of resistance, and there are patients who are not resistant to the CDK4/6 inhibition, and where you just have to change the endocrine backbone.
One more thing I want to ask you about that I actually heard recently, I never heard before, kind of makes sense, but just curious, which is when a program, an investigator made the comment that people on SERDs and PROTACs, and I guess including fulvestrant, have reduced levels of ER if you actually look at their tissue and you do an ER assay. And I'm curious, first of all, does this ever lead to confusion and people think this patient became triple negative or whatever? How much of a decrease do you see in the ER levels if you measure it? And is there any correlation between the amount of decrease of the estrogen receptor and the efficacy?
Well, that is an excellent question. I was also very concerned in the beginning when we did use fulvestrant, which actually has a very long half-life. How long do you have to await to do a new biopsy? But the estrogen receptor turnover is so quick that you will not miss it. You don't have to do it on treatment, but we still see this immunohistochemistry when looking at the estrogen receptor. So this was also my concern. In the window of opportunity trials, preoperatively for 2 to 3 weeks, where we have given these oral SERDs, we indeed see on mRNA level a down regulation, a degradation of the estrogen receptor, also with immunohistochemistry. But still, we can do these biopsies after stopping the SERD. So a lot of mystery still remaining on that particular question that I did hope not to get, but you did pose it, so it's an important question.
This concludes our program. Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA granted approval to imlunestrant for patients with ER-positive, HER2-negative, ESR1-mutated, advanced or metastatic breast cancer with disease progression after at least one line of endocrine therapy. The approval was granted on September 25, 2025, based on data from the EMBER-3 trial. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And during this program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Professor Nevin, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.